thing in my life would not have happened, nor the next, nor any of the other things that led me to my present life, which had made me whole, which had healed me. And I realized something else, something astonishing. This place we were standing in, this completely fluid place, this place of endlessly swirling currents with nothing to hold on to, nothing solid or substantial about it, this place made of water and light and movement. This was my home. I had come home. Standing in that river, I could feel all the loss in my life, all the people I had loved who were no longer there, all the people I loved now who were slipping away, all the things I had hoped for myself and my family, which hadn't happened, and which I now realized never would. But I could also feel the strength and the love that had come in the wake of this loss. And in this place, it was healing to feel all that. There was a fluid sense of wholeness. I had come home. I had made teshuvah. I could feel the transforming power of the time spent circling the bases. Rabbi Soloveitchik said of the prophet Samuel that although he belonged to all of Israel, his true home was only in one place, Ramah. Although he led and judged in many different places, the force of his leadership and judgment stemmed from Ramah, from his home. No matter how great a person may be, he cannot leave his real home. All of his judgments are derived from there. Our home is a river, a fluid place, a place where there is no stopping point, a place where we can stop clinging and stop being driven out of life, a place of teshuvah, a place that will return us to ourselves, where we can feel our lives flowing, healing, toward home. We all live in such a river. Each of the years of our life is a river, and our life as a whole is a river as well. And every pebble beneath our feet is distinct, has been brought here by the movement of the current, by chance and destiny and design. The day of Yom Kippur itself atones. The journey through time which surrounds it heals. If you open yourself to them, these holy days carry you home. Chapter 3. I turned, the walls came down, and there I was. Tisha B'Av. The soul is always teetering between two great tidal pulls, the sun and the moon, the conscious and the unconscious, the mind and the heart. In Judaism, in Jewish ritual, this invisible reality is made visible in various ways. First of all, the Hebrew calendar is the only one in the world that is both lunar and solar. The Roman calendar, which the Western world still follows, is utterly unconscious of the moon. The full moon might occur at the beginning of the month, at the end of it, or in its middle. It's a non-event in the Roman calendar. All of a sudden, we look up and the moon is full, or new, or half full. Unless we are fishermen or farmers, we are caught utterly by surprise. In lunar calendars, on the other hand, it is the revolution of the earth around the sun that is ignored. The Muslim calendar, for example, is lunar, and Ramadan floats happily across the solar year, appearing in autumn one year, and in midwinter the next, and in the spring the year after that. Every Hebrew month follows the cycles of the moon quite precisely. Each new moon is Rosh Chodesh, a minor religious holiday, and most of the major holidays occur on the full moon. But the years follow the cycle of the sun also, albeit with somewhat less precision. We simply throw in an extra month every couple of years. We call this process intercalation. And this ensures that the Jewish year will never be more than a week or two out of phase with the earth's revolution around the sun. So we feel both the sun and the moon in our lives. We feel the phases of the moon tugging at our hearts and our groins, and the progress of the earth through its phases, from summer to autumn, and from winter to spring. This bipolar tidal pull is also reflected in Judaism by the two great yearly spiritual cycles that run in parallel revolutions from one high holiday season to the next, the sacred calendar and the weekly cycle of Torah readings. The sacred calendar begins each year at Rosh Hashanah and continues through Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Hanukkah, Purim, Pesach, Shavuot, and then finally Tisha B'Av. This cycle of festivals carries us from spiritual purification to gratitude and joy, from spiritual renewal to liberation and then to revelation, from the fullness of the year and its attendant decline and death to a pageant of renewal and rebirth. The reading of the Torah has a yearly cycle as well. The entire Torah is read in approximately equal weekly portions every year. On Simchat Torah, the climactic moment of the fall holiday season, the yearly cycle of Torah readings is both completed and begun again in a single reading. The last letter of the Torah is the letter Lamed, or El, the last letter of the Torah's final word, Yisrael. The first letter of the Torah is Beit, or B, the first letter in the word Bereshit, in the beginning. Together, these two letters are themselves a word, the word lev, the Hebrew word for heart. If the sacred calendar traces the path of the soul, then the Torah is the path of the heart. It is, in fact, the heart that keeps the sacred calendar going, that joins its end to its beginning. But just as the sun and the moon feel each other tugging at the surface of the earth and on its seas, just as each of their pulls affects the other, so the sacred calendar and the yearly cycle of Torah readings affect each other too. They often rhyme in subtle ways. They use the same language or address the same issues at the same time. Pesach, for example, is the holiday of physical purification. We get down to essentials. We remove all leaven, all flour that has undergone modification and expansion from our homes, and then finally from our bodies. We possess and we eat only the essence of the flour, the unrisen wheat. And we get rid of that which is stale, all the old flour in our possession. And what do we read in the Torah during the weeks when we are preparing for this purification? The laws concerning the cult of purification at the great sanctuary in the wilderness. Similarly, Hanukkah is the celebration of a particular kind of renewal. The ancient Hasmoneans, also called the Maccabees, who had flirted with the idea of assimilating into Hellenist culture, experience an awakening of sorts, a heroic rededication to the imperatives of the Jewish spiritual impulse. Meanwhile, in the Torah, we are reading the story of Joseph, who rose to power in Egypt, took an Egyptian name, took an Egyptian wife, dressed like an Egyptian, and denied his Jewish brothers both to himself and to his Egyptian patrons. Finally, however, Joseph experienced an awakening, a moment when he realized at last who he was, who he had been all along, and who his brothers really were. There is a similar rhyme between the tidal pull of the Torah reading cycle and the pull of the sacred calendar around Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is a day associated with the various calamities that have befallen the Jewish people since the earliest days of their history, particularly the destruction of the two great temples of Jerusalem. The first temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians on the ninth day of the month of Av. The second temple was destroyed by the Romans on the same date in the year 70 of the Common Era. The Great Temple of Jerusalem was the navel of the universe, the earthly focus of where Israel felt its connection to the divine presence in a palpable way. So Tisha B'Av is primarily about the loss of this connection and the calamity that comes in the wake of this loss. Tisha B'Av always coincides with the beginning of our reading from the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, the second telling, consists for the most part of the repetition of stories and laws we have already heard earlier in the Torah. The first story it tells is the story of a calamity. In the book of Numbers, when the children of Israel first arrived at the boundary of the promised land, God commanded them to scout out the land and then to go up and take it, But the scouts came back full of fear of the inhabitants of the land, of the impending battle with them, of the prospect of being free and having power at last. The Torah is ambiguous on this point. They conveyed their fear to the people, and the people refused to go up and take the land. This refusal became the source of a considerable estrangement between God and Israel. God brought a terrible plague on the Israelites, and it took 40 years of wandering in the desert before they would have another opportunity to enter the promised land. Now, as the book of Deuteronomy opens and the children of Israel again stand on the brink of opportunity, Moses retells them that story. According to the Mishnah, the oldest strata of the Talmud, on Tisha B'Av, we mourn not just the destruction of the temple, but the whole series of calamities that took place both long before and long after that. We also mourn the scouts who were commanded to lead the people into the promised land, but who brought back a misleading report and frightened the people out of going there. We read this story twice, once in Numbers, and again in Deuteronomy, and these two accounts frame the 40 years wandering in the wilderness. We also mourn the fall of Betar, the climactic battle in the unsuccessful revolution against Rome that was waged a century and a half later, and the plowing over of the Temple Mount by the Romans at the end of this war. But these were only the calamities that the rabbis of the Talmudic era were able to associate with this date. Calamities continued to occur at this time of year, and they all became part of the Tisha B'Av mythos. There was an expulsion from England in the 13th century, a 15th century expulsion from Spain, and the various massacres connected with the Crusades. Even the assassination of the Archduke Francis Ferdinand at Sarajevo, the event that precipitated World War I, took place on the 9th day of the month of Av. While this was not a specifically Jewish calamity, some historians see it as the precipitating event of the Holocaust. The Pale of Settlement on the western edge of what became the Soviet Union, where the overwhelming majority of Eastern European Jews lived, became the battleground for World War I. Millions of Jews were displaced by this war, and their displacement left them sitting ducks for the events of World War II. To be sure, tragedy was constantly befalling the Jewish people before and after their exile from Israel, and one could probably compile a similar list to correspond to any time of the year. But the destruction of the temple and the exile it occasioned were signal calamities, and the tendency to telescope calamities around this date served to give form to a significant spiritual feeling, the sense that the same thing was happening over and over again, but in slightly different form, and the corresponding feeling that our unresolved tendencies, the unconscious wrong turns we keep taking, carry us back to the same point on our spiritual path again and again. The Hebrew name for the book of Deuteronomy is Devarim. The opening words of this book are Ele Devarim. These are the words. The book of Deuteronomy literally consists of the words of Moses. It is a first-person narration spoken by Moses, his personal version of events and ideas. The rabbis of the Talmud called this book the Mishnah Torah, the repetition of the law. There is very little in the way of new material in this book. Rather, it is for the most part a rehashing of stories and ideas we heard earlier in the Torah. Only this time, we hear them from Moses himself, rather than from an omniscient third-person narrator. Moses begins with a highly subjective retelling of the incident of the scouts we read about in the book of Numbers. Why does he begin by repeating this material? Because that moment has clearly repeated itself. Once again, Moses and the children of Israel stand at a moment of transformation. Once again, they stand at the edge of the promised land with an opportunity to go up and take it. The last time they stood at this point, this moment of opportunity, they failed to seize it, and they became alienated from God and began a protracted period of exile as a consequence. Now they are being given a second chance. 40 years before, they stood on exactly the same spot, facing exactly the same situation, and now it is time to see if they have learned anything, if they can move past this experience and get on with their lives. Or if they failed to learn, will this same calamity continue to replicate itself until they do? Will the unconscious, unresolved elements in their lives that brought them back to this moment continue to do so, or will they finally get past them? There are two ways of looking at the way our tradition has collapsed history on this day, two ways of thinking about this conflation of calamity. We can regard the ninth of Av and the weeks surrounding it as a cursed time. Indeed, there is something of this idea in the prohibition of weddings during this period. Or we can regard the ninth of Av as a time when we are reminded that catastrophes will keep recurring in our lives until we get things right, until we learn what we need to learn from them. Tisha B'Av comes exactly 7 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, beginning the process that culminates on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Tisha B'Av is the moment of turning, the moment when we turn away from denial and begin to face exile and alienation as they manifest themselves in our own lives, in our alienation and estrangement from God, in our alienation from ourselves and from others. Teshuvah, turning, repentance, is the essential gesture of the high holiday season. It is the gesture by which we seek to heal this alienation and to find at-one-ment, to connect with God, to reconcile with others, and to anchor ourselves in the ground of our actual circumstances, so that it is this reality that shapes our actions and not just the habitual unconscious momentum of our lives. Rambam, the great medieval philosopher and synthesizer of Jewish law, said that teshuvah, this kind of moral and spiritual turning, is only complete when we find ourselves in exactly the same position we were in when we went wrong, when the state of estrangement and alienation began, and we choose to behave differently, to act in a way that is conducive to atonement and reconciliation. But this objection was raised. What happens if the circumstances in question don't repeat themselves? How do we make complete teshuvah then? Don't worry, the Rambam replied. They always do. The unresolved elements of our lives, the unconscious patterns, the conflicts and problems that seem to arise no matter where we go or with whom we find ourselves, continue to pull us into the same moral and spiritual circumstances over and over again until we figure out how to resolve them. They continue to carry us into harm's way until we become aware of them, conscious of them, and begin to change them. And we all have recurring motifs in the dark, unresolved corners of our lives, in the domestic unhappiness we replicate from one marriage to another, in the problems that seem to follow us from one job to the next, in all the mistakes that turn out to be the same mistake which we make over and over. This is why Moses begins the book of Deuteronomy, the second telling, the repetition of the way, with his own version of the story of the scouts. He realizes the Israelites are in precisely the same spiritual and moral predicament they found themselves in 40 years before. The unresolved issues of their lives have brought them there. And this explains a second element that Moses' story and the tradition of Tisha B'Av have in common, and that is the strange tendency of Moses in the first case and the rabbis of the Talmud in the second to blame the people themselves for what happened. In the original account of the scouts, the third-person narration we read in the Book of Numbers, the people were certainly not without blame. They were gullible and far too easily led into a panic. But the principal blame seemed to lie elsewhere, particularly on the perfidious and cowardly scouts, the princes of the tribes who projected their fear onto what they saw. When they returned, they described a place far worse, far more terrifying than the one they had actually seen. This projection incited the people to fearfulness and finally to disobedience, to a refusal to do what they were clearly meant to do next. But later, in Deuteronomy, Moses tells the story very differently. He shifts the blame from the exaggerated and ultimately dishonest story the spies told to the murmuring of the people who heard the report. The people are no longer innocents, misled into disobedience. Moses subtly alters the narrative in this retelling to place the burden of guilt on them, and not their princes. We see precisely the same kind of thing in the Tisha B'Av story. Why was the temple destroyed, the rabbis of the Talmud asked? Because of Sinat Hinam, gratuitous hatred. Because the Jewish people had fallen into factional bickering, because they had broken up into warring cults and were busily engaged in fratricidal religious disputes, each one claiming to be the true Israel and denying the legitimacy of all the others. Isaiah Gaffney is an Israeli professor of ancient history. On holidays celebrating ancient historical events, he is frequently asked to appear on Israeli radio and TV to participate in panels with other learned commentators. On Tisha B'Av, there is invariably a commentator from the Israeli left who explains that the temple was destroyed and Israel was conquered by the Romans because of the intolerance of the religious right of that day. Then a right-wing commentator explains that both the temple and Israel itself fell to the Romans because of the failure of the Jewish people to unite against the enemy militarily. Then it invariably falls upon Gaffney to explain that there was one reason for the fall of the temple and one reason alone. Rome was absolutely invincible, and its huge armies were marching through the world mowing down everyone in their path, and nothing could have stopped them from taking Jerusalem, no matter how tolerant the religious right, nor how unified the armies of Israel might have been. So what were the rabbis of the Talmud talking about when they said that the temple was destroyed by gratuitous hatred? What was Moses talking about? Why did they blame the people for what had happened when the objective evidence of history clearly seems to exonerate them? The answer is that neither the rabbis nor Moses cared a fig about history. They weren't historians, they were spiritual leaders. And spiritually, the only question worth asking about any conflict, any recurring catastrophe, is this: what is my responsibility for it? How am I complicit in it? How can I prevent it from happening again? When things go bad, there is an enormous temptation to blame it on externals, on the evil of others, or on an unlucky turn of events. Spiritually, however, we are called to resist this temptation, no matter how strong it may be, and no matter how strongly rooted in fact or reason or history it may seem. Spiritually, we are called to responsibility, to ask, what am I doing to make this recur again and again? Even if it is a conflict that was clearly thrust upon me from the outside, how am I plugging into it? What is there in me that needs to be engaged in this conflict? Why can't I just let it slough off me like water off a duck's back, as I am able to do with so many other things? Our power in this world is considerable, but also very circumscribed. It is only here and now, in this moment, in this place, in the present, that we can act. We cannot act in the past. We cannot act in the future, and most certainly we cannot act through someone else's experience. So from a spiritual point of view, we need to ask, what can I do here and now in the present tense reality of my own experience? And that is precisely where Moses and the rabbis are trying to point the people, to their own experience, which is the only place where they are empowered to act. Why do our relationships always fail in precisely the same way? Why do we always fall into the same kind of conflict at work? Why do we always have the same arguments with our children, with our parents? Sure, there may be plenty of evidence in the history of your life to suggest that it was always the other guy's fault. That first husband was a real schmuck. Look at what happened with his second marriage. And that guy at work you are in conflict with now is the last of the Schmohegans, no doubt about it. And that guy you were in conflict with last time was also a terrible Schmohawk. But we aren't talking about history here. We are talking about our spiritual growth. And in terms of our spiritual growth, what we really need to ask is this. What is my complicity? Why do I always end up fighting with schmohawks? Why does every man I have a relationship with end up taking advantage of me? How can I make things better in the here and now of my actual experience, the only time and place in which I am empowered to act? What is the recurring disaster in our life? What is the unresolved element that keeps bringing us back to this same moment over and over again? What is it that we keep getting wrong? What is it that we persistently refuse to look at, fail to see? Tisha B'Av is the day on which we are reminded of the calamity that keeps repeating itself in the life of our people. And against all reason, against the overwhelming evidence of history, Moses and the rabbis insist that we are not powerless in the face of that calamity. Moses and the rabbis insist that we take responsibility for what is happening to us. Moses and the rabbis insist that we acknowledge our complicity in the things that keep happening to us over and over again. I think that the great philosopher George Santayana got it exactly wrong. I think it is precisely those who insist on remembering history who are doomed to repeat it. For a subject with so little substance, for something that is really little more than a set of intellectual interpretations, history can become a formidable trap, a sticky snare from which we may find it impossible to extricate ourselves. I find it impossible to read the texts of Tisha B'Av with their great themes of exile and return and their endless sense of longing for the land of Israel without thinking of the current political tragedy in the Middle East. I write this at a very dark moment in the long and bleak history of that conflict. Who knows what will be happening there when you hear this? But I think it's a safe bet that whenever you do, one thing is unlikely to have changed. There will likely be a tremendous compulsion for historical vindication on both sides. Very often I think it is precisely the impossible yearning for historical justification that makes resolution of this conflict seem so impossible. The Jews want vindication for the Holocaust and for the 2,000 years of European persecution and ostracism that preceded it. The Jews want the same Europeans who now give them moral lectures to acknowledge that this entire situation would never have come about if not for 2,000 years of European bigotry, barbarism, and xenophobia. They want the world to acknowledge that Israel was attacked first, in 1948, in 1967, in 1973, and in each of the recent intifadas. They want acknowledgement that they only took the lands from which they were attacked during these conflicts and offered to return them on one and only one condition, the acknowledgement of their right to exist. When Anwar Sadat met that condition, the Sinai Peninsula, with its rich oil fields and burgeoning settlement towns, was returned to him. And they want acknowledgement that there are many in the Palestinian camp who truly wish to destroy them, who have used the language of peace as a ploy to buy time until they have the capacity to liquidate Israel and the Jews once and for all. They want acknowledgement that they have suffered immensely from terrorism, that a people who lost 6 million innocents scarcely 70 years ago should not have had to endure the murder of its innocent men, women, and children so soon again. And they want acknowledgement that in spite of all this, they stood at Camp David prepared to offer the Palestinians everything they claimed to have wanted. Full statehood, a capital in East Jerusalem. And the response of the Palestinians was the Second Intifada, a murderous campaign of terror and suicide bombings. And the Palestinians? They would like the world to acknowledge that they lived in the land now called Israel for centuries, that they planted olive trees, shepherded flocks, and raised families there for hundreds of years. They would like the world to acknowledge that when they look up from their blue-roofed villages, their trees and their flowers, their fields and their flocks, they see the horrific, uninvited monolith of Western culture, immense apartment complexes, shopping centers, and industrial plants on the once bare and rocky hills where the voice of God could be heard and where Muhammad ascended to heaven. And they would like the world to acknowledge that it was essentially a European problem that was plopped into their laps at the end of the last great war, not one of their own making. They would like the world to acknowledge that there has always been a kind of arrogance attached to this problem, that it was as if the United States and England said to them, "Here are the Jews, get used to them." And they would like the world to acknowledge that it is a great indignity, not to mention a significant hardship, to have been an occupied people for so long, to have had to submit to strip searches on the way to work, and intimidation on the way to the grocery store, and the constant humiliation of being subject, a humiliation rendered nearly bottomless when Israel, with the benefit of the considerable intellectual and economic resources of world Jewry, made the desert bloom in a way they had never been able to do. And they would like the world to acknowledge that there are those in Israel who are determined never to grant them independence, who have used the language of peace as a ploy to fill the West Bank with settlement after settlement until the facts on the ground are such that an independent Palestinian state on the West Bank is an impossibility. They would like the world to acknowledge that there is no such thing as a gentle occupation, that occupation corrodes the humanity of the occupier and makes the occupied vulnerable to brutality. And I think the need to have these things acknowledged, the need for historical affirmation, is so great on both sides that both the Israelis and the Palestinians would rather perish as peoples than give this need up. In fact, I think they both feel that they would perish as peoples precisely if they did. They would rather die than admit their own complicity in the present situation, because to make such an admission would be to acknowledge the suffering of the other and the legitimacy of the other's complaint. And that might mean that they themselves were wrong, that they were evil, that they were bad. That might give the other an opening to annihilate or enslave them. That might make such behavior seem justifiable. I wonder how many of us are stuck in a similar snare. I wonder how many of us are holding on very hard to some piece of personal history that is preventing us from moving on with our lives and keeping us from those we love. I wonder how many of us cling so tenaciously to a version of the story of our lives in which we appear to be utterly blameless and innocent, that we become oblivious to the pain we have inflicted on others, no matter how unconsciously or inevitably or innocently we may have inflicted it. I wonder how many of us are terrified of acknowledging the truth of our lives because we think it will expose us. How many of us stand paralyzed between the moon and the sun, frozen, unable to act in the moment because of our terror of the past and because of the intractability of the present circumstances that past has wrought? Forgiveness, it has been said, means giving up our hopes for a better past. This may sound like a joke, but how many of us refuse to give up our version of the past, and so find it impossible to forgive ourselves or others, impossible to act in the present? Tisha B'Av is the beginning of Teshuvah, the process of turning that we hope to complete on Yom Kippur, the process of returning to ourselves and to God. And the acknowledgement of the unresolved in our lives, as a people and as individuals, is the beginning of the sacred power the days of awe grant us, to transform our lives in this moment when we feel the pull of both the waning moon and the setting sun in this place, in this life, here and now. The psalmist promises us, "The guardian of those who struggle to know God never slumbers nor sleeps. He will protect you. He will not let the sun smite you by day nor the moon by night." During the Watergate investigation, Deep Throat told reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein to follow the money. In Torah study, the watchword is follow the language. A given Torah portion will often convey its essential meaning by repeating a particular word or word root, shoresh, a significant number of times. 3 times, 7 times, 10 times. These are the most common magic numbers, although among these, 7 is the one most frequently employed. These repeated words become a kind of leitmotif, a theme that points us to the central action of the portion and invites us to explore the word in question for a broader and deeper range of meanings. In the first portion of Deuteronomy, the portion we always read the week of Tisha B'Av, the word that is repeated 7 times is the root fanach, to turn. Rav lachem, God says, the time is up for living on this mountain. Turn, fanu, and begin your journey. And we turned, venefen, and we passed by the way of the wilderness of Moab. And we turned, venefen, and we went up to Bashan. To turn is certainly a redolent verb, but one of the unmistakable suggestions of its repeated usage here is that the children of Israel have once again reached a significant turning point. They stand once again at the border of the promised land. Once again, life and God are conspiring to confront them with a clear and frightening imperative. Go up and take the land. Rav lachem. The time has come for this. This is what you must do next in order for your life to proceed. This is what you must do in order to move on to the next stage of your journey. 40 years ago, of course, the children of Israel resisted this imperative and did not go up, and as a consequence, their lives ground to a standstill. Now the turning point has come round again. The calendar of the sacred year presents us with a succession of turning points, and, Rav Lachem, each turn comes in its own time. The number 7, the number associated with creation and light, is always connected with these turning points. 7 weeks before Pesach, we turn toward the process of purification that will culminate during the week of Pesach itself by celebrating Shabbat Shekalim, the first of a number of special Sabbaths, designed to draw us into this process by calling our attention to it. Pesach itself is a turning point. It is exactly 7 weeks before Shavuot. Pesach commemorates liberation, the exodus from Egypt, and Shavuot celebrates revelation, the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai. Liberation, the calendar suggests, is the great turning point on the road to revelation. Exactly 7 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, we mark the turn toward Teshuvah, repentance or return, with the observance of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av is the beginning of Teshuvah, the point of turning toward this process by turning toward a recognition of our estrangement from God, from ourselves, and from others. Yom Kippur is the culmination of the process that begins on Tisha B'Av, when we acknowledge the darkness, when we let our guard down, when we turn toward the truth. The natural event connected to Tisha B'Av is the height of summer, the fullness of the year. 6 days later, on the 15th of Av, the summer actually reaches its peak and begins to decline. The sap in the trees reaches its full strength and begins to turn toward dryness. The days reach their full length and begin to shorten. Fullness and decline are intimately linked. The end of one is the beginning of the other. Conversely, decline and destruction necessarily precede renewal. Tearing down is necessary before rebuilding is possible. And all these things, fullness, decline, destruction, renewal, tearing down, rebuilding, are actually part of the same process, points on a single continuum, consecutive segments of a never-ending circle. The time between Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, this great 7-week time of turning, is the time between the destruction of Jerusalem, the crumbling of the walls of the Great Temple, and our own moral and spiritual reconstruction. The year has been building itself up, and now it begins to let go. The natural cycle of the cosmos, the rise and fall, the impermanence and the continuity all express themselves in this turning. The walls come down and suddenly we can see. Suddenly we recognize the nature of our estrangement from God, and this recognition is the beginning of our reconciliation. We can see the image of the falling temple, the burning house, that Tisha B'Av urges upon us so forcefully, precisely in this light. One of the extraordinary things about the Torah is the amount of time and space it devotes to the physical details of the sanctuary in the wilderness, the great tabernacle, the prototype for the great temple of Jerusalem. Almost half the book of Exodus, the last five weekly Torah portions of this book, is given over to a minute and repetitive description of this structure. This schema is repeated as the children of Israel gather the necessary materials to build it, then repeated as they begin to execute the design, and then finally repeated one more time as the erection of the tabernacle is completed. The classical commentators, who are rarely at a loss for words, make a few forced symbolic interpretations of these structural details, and then fall silent as they are repeated over and over. Page after page goes by without any commentary at all, a happenstance replicated nowhere else in the Torah. The point seems to be that the Torah is not trying to teach us, nor even to tell us anything here. Rather, it seems interested in simply engraving the image of the tabernacle in our psyches, as if it were spiritually important to have this image there, as if there were something in the structure of the tabernacle we need to impose on our own inner structure, as if we need to bring our own inner life into harmony with this design. It has occurred to me in recent years that the Jewish calendar year does the same thing with another image, and that is the image of the fall of the temple. It does this through a series of public fasts. On the 15th of Tevet, which falls in late November and December, we fast in memory of the beginning of the siege of Jerusalem. On the 17th of Tammuz, a midsummer month, we fast in memory of the breaching of the walls of the city of Jerusalem toward the end of this siege. Exactly 3 weeks later, on the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av, we observe a major fast, the longest and most difficult fast of the year, to remember the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple. Then, 7 weeks later, and one day after Rosh Hashanah, we observe the fast of Gedaliah. Gedaliah was the Jewish governor who presided over Israel after it had been conquered by the Babylonians. He was assassinated by Jewish zealots, disgruntled Jewish monarchists, and after his death, the Jews were cleaned out of the land of Israel and shipped off to a Babylonian exile. So, the fast of Gedaliah marks the beginning of the Jewish diaspora, the exile. This image, this series of fasts, tells our bodies and our souls the story of the encroachment of emptiness, the story of impermanence. There was a great temple, a great nation with its capital in Jerusalem, but even such seemingly unshakable institutions as these simply slipped away into the mists of history. Yet even while it stood, the great temple was a structure that was centered around emptiness. The Holy of Holies, the sacred center upon which all the elaborate structural elegance of the temple served to focus, was primarily a vacated space. It was defined that way in the Torah. The Holy of Holies was the space no one could enter except the high priest, and even he could only enter for a few moments on Yom Kippur. If anyone else entered this place, or if the high priest entered on any other day, the charged emptiness at the sacred center, the powerful nothingness there, would break out on him and overwhelm him, and he would die. So, Yom Kippur is, among other things, the day we enter the vacated space, even if only by proxy, the day we experience the charged emptiness at the sacred center. On Tisha B'Av, it is as if this emptiness has broken loose from its bounds and swallowed everything up. The temple burns. The emptiness once confined to the center of the temple now characterizes it completely. This image touches us deeply because we are always under siege. and we are held there by our attempts to hold off the emptiness we intuit at the center of our lives. In The Denial of Death, Ernest Becker observed that while all sentient beings die, we humans are the only ones who know that we will die. All of our lives, according to Becker, are an accommodation to this dreaded intelligence. Terrified of this emptiness, seeing it as utter negation, we defend against it with all our might. Against the encroachment of nothingness, we fill our lives with stuff. Against the ultimate negation, we strive for success. Against the hard information that we came from nothing and end there as well. Against the resulting suspicion that we might in fact be nothing all the while, we struggle mightily to construct an identity, but we're never quite persuaded by it. Some deep instinct keeps whispering to us that it isn't real, and the walls keep falling down, and then the city finally collapses, and the identity we have been laboring so desperately to shore up collapses along with it. As a rabbi, as a member of a family, as a friend, I have often witnessed the crumbling of these walls. I have often seen divorce shake up people's idea of who they are. It can destroy an identity based on being a happy spouse, or uncover the emptiness we often try to hide with a relationship that was never really gratifying. If we have invested our identities in our work, if we believe we are defined by what we do, retirement or dismissal can be a devastating trauma. I have known many men who have suffered strokes or heart attacks in the months after retirement. Several have actually died. And getting fired, even from a terrible job, often leads to a debilitating depression. If we see ourselves primarily as parents, as protectors of our children, then the walls can come tumbling down when our children suffer. A woman in my congregation had poured all her life's energy into creating the perfect family. She had 3 children, each one more talented and brilliant than the next. The eldest was a boy, bright, handsome, and a gifted musician. She often had him play the trumpet for her dinner guests. And he often sang duets with his younger sister, the middle child, an adorable blonde. They sang Dites-moi from South Pacific. The woman herself was brilliant and beautiful as well, and she was extremely ambitious. She had come from a very poor background and had suffered disgrace and ostracism as a child. But now her husband was a successful doctor, and her children were too good to be true. She was the envy of everyone, and soon became the center of an increasingly prestigious succession of social circles. Her husband acquired famous patients, and she began to socialize with them. Her first 2 children were accepted at Ivy League universities, and none of this happened by accident. She had made it happen. Her husband had wanted to begin his practice in a comfortable rural community. He might have made a nice living there, but he would have been a non-entity if she hadn't insisted that he practice in a major urban center instead. And the children required constant prodding, constant pushing, constant reminding that their success and failure were a reflection on her. She was beautiful and generous, but she had a very sharp edge. Then her son, the bright, handsome musician, had a major breakdown. He came home from college and curled up on his bed in the fetal position. When people came to visit, they asked about him and wondered why he never came out. His mother would turn beet red then, but it was far worse when he did come out. Always a quiet and rail-thin blonde, he was now coarse and overweight. He would sit in the living room in a funk, insulting his mother's visitors, several times driving them from the house. This went on for years. There was a seemingly endless succession of psychiatrists, mental institutions, tawdry apartments, weird encounters with strangers on the streets, desperate trips to Europe and the Caribbean. In between, he would always come home. He would lie on his bed in the fetal position. He would sit in the living room and insult his mother's friends. His mother was devastated. Her ascent up the ladder of social success came to a complete halt. Life became a humiliation for her. Social visits were a nightmare. Either there was the heavy presence of her absent son emanating from the bedroom, or her son's actual presence, coarse and angry and abusive. And then, of course, there was her son's suffering. Above and beyond the social implications of all this was the fact that she really did love her son desperately, and her son appeared to be dying of misery. She felt the walls of her world falling down all around her. Then, after 3 or 4 years, the misery ended as suddenly and as mysteriously as it had begun. The son met a young woman. They fell in love. They married and had 3 children. His life regulated itself in almost every way. There was almost no trace of those years of near madness and rage. And when the smoke had cleared, it was apparent to everyone that there was no trace of his mother's hard edge anymore. No trace of her social ambitions. Her son's nightmare and his sudden, inexplicable recovery from it had softened her. The walls of her ego had crumbled. Her son had torn them down. But everyone who knew her agreed she was the better for it. She was warmer, softer. She had a deeper sense of what was important in her life. We spend a great deal of time and energy propping up our identity, an identity we realize at bottom is really a construct. So it is that we are always living at some distance from ourselves. We live in a fearful state of siege, trying to prop up an identity that keeps crumbling, that we secretly intuit to be empty. Then Tisha B'Av comes and the walls begin to crumble, and then the entire city collapses. But something persists, something fundamentally nameless and empty, something that remains when all else has fallen away. Something remained when the temple was destroyed 2,000 years ago. This was perhaps the most significant turning point in Jewish history. Judaism continued without the temple, an inconceivable possibility at the time. But the truth is that if the temple had never been destroyed, the renewal Judaism needed so badly could never have taken place. If the walls of the temple had never fallen down, the fundamental spiritual impulse of Judaism, the powerful emptiness at its core, may very well have been smothered. Many years ago, in Northern California, I knew a man named Moshe. And to tell you the truth, I couldn't stand the guy. He was an early follower of Shlomo Carlebach, the spiritual leader and musician, and was always barefoot, always stoned, always breaking out into spontaneous dancing, and always positively oozing a very unconvincing brand of joy. I thought he was a phony, and the phoniest thing about him was the dancing and the ersatz bliss. But one summer I went to Jerusalem, and I was on the Temple Mount for the observance of Tisha B'Av, and I ran into this Moshe there. Now, since it was Tisha B'Av, and since he was a devoted Neo-Hasid who felt compelled to enter fully into the emotional imperatives of every holiday, he was not exuding joy. Rather, he was allowing himself to feel the sadness of Tisha B'Av as fully as he could. And suddenly I loved the guy. Suddenly he seemed utterly sincere. I think this Moshe was a genuinely depressed individual. All that dancing and joy had been an exhausting overlay on his natural personality. But now, because of Tisha B'Av, he was allowing himself to feel depressed, and he seemed completely authentic. When the walls crumbled, when the facade of fake joy fell away, he was real. He was authentically who he was. And that's why I liked him so much. Suddenly I saw him as a man at a turning point, someone who had let the siege end, who had let the walls come all the way down, who had let the city fall, someone willing to ask, "Who am I really? What will be left when the walls of constructed identity come down?" He was someone who had followed the ancient imperative and said, "Rav Lachem, the time has come. The time has come to get off it, to drop the mask. After all, in 7 weeks we will stand before the one who sees through all masks. The time has come to turn." So the Torah tells us 7 times, B'nei Fen Ufinu, and they turned, now you turn. What is required of us at Tisha B'Av is a simple turn of mind, a turn toward consciousness, a turn away from denial, from the inertia, from the passive momentum of our lives, a turn away from those things that continue to happen unconsciously, and a conscious decision to change. A letting go, letting the walls of identity crumble, and turning toward that which remains. My first congregation was in Monroe, New York, right on the edge of the Catskill Mountains. The Catskills were an important part of my family mythology. My father had spent his teenage years there. His mother ran a boarding house, Lou's Wayside Inn, after she was divorced from his father. My parents both worked in Catskill hotels during the summertime when they were first married and my father was struggling to get through dental school. They couldn't afford a place to live, and the help quarters were intolerable. My mother was assigned a big strapping roommate, a waitress from the Pennsylvania coal mining country. This woman was making more money entertaining gentlemen callers in their room late at night than she was making in the dining room. My mother couldn't take it. She and my father ended up sleeping out in the fields together every night. It was wonderfully romantic. My father died a few years before I became a rabbi in Monroe. The Catskills held precious memories for my mother. So one day during my first year at Monroe, about a week before Tisha B'Av, my wife and I took her on a sentimental journey to the Catskills. She would show us Lou's Wayside Inn. She would show us the hotel she had worked in that first year and the fields where she and my father had slept. She would show us the hotel where she and my father had worked together their second summer there as well. But when we got up to the Catskills, it was all gone. There was no trace of any of it. The first hotel had become a prison. The field where my mother and father had lain together all those summer nights was now filled to bursting with the Quonset huts and chain-link fences of a state mental hospital. The second hotel had become a yeshiva. And Lou's Wayside Inn? Who knew? The road that used to lead there didn't even exist anymore. It simply stopped dead in its tracks about a half a mile before the inn, shrubs and weeds gaping out from where the roadbed used to be. By this time, my mother was weeping profusely in the back seat. She wept all the way back to Monroe. Finally, she came to herself. "I'm glad we went," she said. "It was important." God knows why my mother felt it was important to witness such a relentless demonstration of the impermanence of the life she had known in the Catskills. I doubt if she could have explained what she meant by this herself, but what I took her to mean was that she understood that this was the only way she could have that life, only by being willing to experience loss, by letting the walls of memory crumble, could she have it. This is the bet life always makes against us. Life bets that we won't be willing to endure the suffering it requires. Life bets that we will try to shut out the suffering, and so shut out life in the bargain. Tisha B'Av sidles up to us, whispering conspiratorially with a racing form over its mouth. Tisha B'Av has a hot tip for us. Take the suffering. Take the loss. Turn toward it. Embrace it. Let the walls come down. And Tisha B'Av has a few questions for us as well. Where are we? What transition point are we standing at? What is causing sharp feeling in us, disturbing us, knocking us a little off balance? Where is our suffering? What is making us feel bad? What is making us feel at all? How long will we keep the walls up? How long will we furiously defend against what we know deep down to be the truth of our lives? When will we turn? Will we let the walls of our psyche fall with the walls of the great temple? Will we let in the truth we have been walling out all year long, and let this truth help us to stop making the same mistakes again and again? Will we let this moment of consciousness help us break the unconscious momentum of our lives? Will we move from a state of siege to a state of openness, to a state of truthfulness, especially with ourselves? What might we see as a result? What deep wellspring would suddenly become apparent to us? What pattern would we see ourselves repeating?